long.
This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, January 24, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana. Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios in Connecticut. Taylor, interesting show today. A lot of stuff to get to. Was there one Hall of Fame candidate whose ballot, whose candidacy that you were really focused on?
I really wanted Gary Sheffield to get in. After last week's show, and we played the clip of Xavier Scruggs talking to him about how, I mean, he got dogged, dude. Like, it is crazy how wrong he's been done. For him to not get in, that really bummed me out, unfortunately. It should be a celebratory day, but, you know, I think with the Baseball Hall of Fame, we think about things like this, which is a bummer.
Yeah. Did it surprise you? Because, you know, you weren't a baseball fan, or you weren't a huge baseball fan, and you weren't working in the industry when the Mitchell report was generated. I'm curious to see if any of that nuance sort of landed with you, because I, you know, as you know, anybody who's in the Mitchell report is now is like the, you know, has the scarlet A on their chest, or I guess the scarlet S for steroids on their chest, because they're in that report. And yet the way that it was generated was so terrible, and it has its long lasting effect on the, you know, the what was it, 89 players who were in the report.
I truly had no idea. You know, when you hear that, like, oh, they were named in the Mitchell report, like you said, that's a scarlet letter on you. And the fact that I mean, I had no idea there was any nuance to any of this. I thought that, you know, especially like when I was younger and this stuff came out, it's just like, okay, that person's used steroids and they cheated and that's sort of it. And so now that we're, you know, 20 plus years later and we're talking about it, like it's wild that this hasn't been dealt with or discussed as like, hey, maybe there should be some retrospective on the whole thing.
Oh, 100%. I mean, I thought it was a joke when they were doing it. But now that we have some time, I really wish at some point Major League Baseball would have a conversation about basically taking the Mitchell report and throwing it into the trash bin of history, because it was, you know, it's just really, really an awful thing. Anyway, we're taping this on Wednesday morning, right after the Hall of Fame election results were announced on Tuesday night. We're going to hear from Eduardo Perez about all that, about what separated Adrian Beltre, Joe Mauer, Todd Helton, and how in the world 19 voters didn't cast votes for Beltre. But today we'll also be hearing from Charlie Culberson, who has decided now in his mid-30s that he's going to work to transition from being an infielder, as he has been for 11 years in the big leagues, to pitching. And it's very interesting. He had some conversations with guys that he's played with about pitching that I think you're going to want to hear about. All right. This was the sound of Adrian Beltre getting the call from the Hall of Fame yesterday.
Cooperstown, New York.
You ready?
Yeah.
Answer it.
John, I'm going to go to the
answer.
Hello.
Hello, may I speak with Adrian Beltre, please?
Yes, sir. This is him.
Adrian, this is Jack O'Connell, the baseball, calling you from the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. Your new second home, the baseball writers have elected you to the Hall of Fame.
Thank you so much. Oh, it's official.
They couldn't get him to answer the phone, Taylor. What's up with that?
He must have been so nervous that he totally froze it. He didn't know how to turn it on speaker. His son leans over and turns it on speaker for him. I mean, I can empathize. That's got to be nerve wracking.
That's awesome. He had the highest vote percentage for any player in the results that were announced on Tuesday, 95.1%. Joe Mauer was named on 76.1% of the ballots in his first year of eligibility. Here's what his call sounded like.
Can I speak with Joe Mauer, please?
This is.
Hi, Joe. This is Jack O'Connell with the Baseball Writers Association. I think the last time I spoke with you was to notify you of your American League MVP. Mm-hmm. And I have a much bigger message for you today. The Baseball Writers have elected you to the Hall of Fame. Congratulations, my friend.
Wow, Jack. That's unbelievable. I don't even know what to say.
Yeah.
I'll say I can't wait until the summer and seeing you shortly. This is unbelievable news, and I'm just so thankful and grateful.
Joe Mauer with emotions voice. Jack O'Connell does a great job of those calls on behalf of the Baseball Writers Association. And then there's Todd Helton, who was on a 6-year in the ballot, He got 79.7%. Here's the, what his call sounded like.
Hello? You got it? Yes? Great. Thank you so much.
How about that one, Taylor? That is perfect Todd Helton. Talk about understating.
He didn't put it on speakerphone. There's a room full of people. I don't know what he's saying. I mean, but great, great scenes there all around. That's so much fun to watch those.
Yeah, 100%. I'm glad we did that way. All right, some other news and notes that generated within baseball in the last week. Josh Hader and the Astros agreed to a record 5-year, $95 million. That deal has no deferred money, unlike Edwin Diaz, who's got a bunch of deferrals in his contract. Diaz's deal worth $93 million. Hader surpassing that with 5 years, $95 million to be the Astros, I guess, co-closer. They talked to Ryan Pressly about all that. We're going to be talking with Paul Hembekides about this contract coming up. The Pirates signed Aroldis Chapman to a 1-year, $10.5 million deal. The Brewers are finalizing a deal with free agent first baseman Rhys Hoskins on a 2-year, $34 million deal. The Nationals have signed Joey Gallo, 1-year, $5 million. The Dodgers, who spent so much money this winter, that hasn't slowed down. They agreed to a deal with pitcher James Paxton, his deal worth something in the range of $12 million. The Angels have been really busy loading up on their bullpen. They re-signed Matt Moore, and they also signed first baseman and DH Miguel Sano. We did get sad news the other day. Cubs great and Hall of Famer Ryne Sandberg announced that he has been diagnosed with cancer. He said on social media that he has metastatic prostate cancer and has begun treatment there. Here's the sound of Mike Greenberg, who knew Sandberg from his days working in Chicago, talking about the Cubs' former second baseman.
We have remained in touch over the years and sending cards and notes back and forth and whatever it is. And like most things, like, you just assume there's always going to be time for stuff. Like, we've always talked about how, oh, we got to get together again. And of course, you don't. You keep kicking that can down the road. And then all of a sudden one day, you know, you're looking on social media and the Cubs are wishing their best to Ryne Sandberg. And there's a picture of him in a hospital and all of that. And it just it floored me when I saw it yesterday. So young. And again, we are not eulogizing Ryne Sandberg today. We are endlessly hopeful and sending every ounce of energy. And if you are one who sends prayers, I certainly would direct them in his way. He's just a great guy. By the way, the Cubs will unveil a statue of Ryne Sandberg at Wrigley Field on June 23rd, which is an event that I now have every intention of attending. Mm.
Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, today, that is Wednesday, a new episode of the College Game Day podcast is being recorded. Hopefully there'll be some news on Jim Harbaugh, if he's going to the NFL, if he's staying at Michigan.
He's going to the Chargers. What are we even like talking about? Yeah, he's going to the Chargers.
I hope the news breaks before they start recording, because I feel like they're going to record an episode and it's going to break at like 7 o'clock tonight and they're going to have to do another one. So for their sake, I hope it breaks soon. A lot of good stuff going on. A lot of transfer portal action. Ohio State, they find their quarterback in Julian Sain. So check it out. The College Game Day podcast. You can listen to it on this platform or watch it on YouTube.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
Eduardo Perez played a long time in the big leagues. He's an analyst on Sunday Night Baseball, and he's joining us today, the day after he learns about who among his peers was voted into the Hall of Fame. Eduardo, how you doing?
I am doing very well, Buster. I think this is my maiden voyage of 2024 with you.
Yeah, that's right.
So
in fact,
cool.
As you were talking, I was thinking, Taylor, you can jump in here. I'm thinking we got to do some sort of an open thing for Eduardo. What do you think?
Just yeah. he can pop in whenever he wants. Is that what we're thinking?
No, I'm not talking about opening on the show. I'm talking about, you know, we have this elaborate opening for the Rabbi train. We've got.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we need to punch it up. Buster, we're talking strategy after we record today. So we're going to put that on the agenda, Eduardo, top of the list.
Nice.
Absolutely. Especially after I ended up getting this right here, Buster. It's my 10-year Disney plaque. 10 years.
Very nice. So way to go.
So pumped up. Mickey!
All right. Well, if you agree with me, the chances of you getting a special open improve. And so we'll see what we have to say about the Hall of Fame situation. I definitely have some strong thoughts about guys who didn't get in. But let's go positive first. I want to hear stories from you about the three guys who did get voted in. And we'll start with the guy who had the highest percentage, Adrian Beltre. You know, whether it's an anecdote or observations, what jumps to mind?
What jumps to mind is simple. Adrian Beltre deserved that 95% plus votes that he got in. This guy reinvented who he was after going to Boston for 1 year and then went to Texas and made it his home. I was a teammate of Adrian Beltre in 2006 when I got traded from then the Cleveland Indians to the Seattle Mariners. And in that half season, I saw a player that had so much potential that he still didn't know who he really was or was going to be at the major league level. He was an impact defensive third baseman. He was a guy that I thought had more in the tank as a third baseman. I thought his preparation was still lacking to be a great. And then all of a sudden has a bad 2009 year, injury plagued 2009 year, did not get over 500 at-bats that year, only hit 8 home runs that year. And it was the Boston Red Sox that took a gamble on a guy that had already shown potential. And when he went to Boston, he figured it out. The 49 doubles he hit there. The 27 or 28 home runs that he hit that year also in Boston played. The Texas Rangers reaped those rewards of a guy that could lead, a guy that could hit, a guy that could play defense, a guy that also could lead not only the Latino players, as Ron Washington said in an interview, but he could also lead the entire squad. And I think it has a lot to do with the combination of having come up in a Dodger system that also emphasized the importance of being able to not only teach the language, and that's the English language to the player, but also the English culture, the American culture. And he was able to blend those two together with his experiences in LA, in Seattle, in Boston, and make himself into a Hall of Famer, finish it off for those years with the Texas Rangers, rightfully so.
I love the story that Terry Francona used to say when he had him, he managed him for 1 year in Boston, about how if he had a day when he didn't have Beltre in the lineup, maybe because of what he'd heard from the athletic trainers about a nagging injury, or maybe he just wanted to rest him, he said Beltre would want to fight. Like, yeah. Beltre worked to get into the lineup every day. And you know, he and Francona and others talked about how important that was to have a player be a leader in that regard.
But it was the 2009 season that defined him. He didn't like being hurt. He did not like being in that lineup. He did not like not being productive. And he took that one-year gamble, that one-year deal. He said, I'm going to play. I'm going to play in a big market in Boston, in the American League East, and I'm going to put up some serious numbers. And he used the entire field. It wasn't just because the monster. When I said the monster, just out of respect here, to all the New Englanders. It's about the energy that he had. And once he was able to sign that deal with Texas, he was able to now lead with the word in Spanish is gusto, with a love for the game. And that translated to his players, to his peers, to his teammates, and most importantly, to his fans, to the Texas Rangers fans. And it was just a sight to watch. Watch Adrian Beltre when he goes to third base, what he does. Throws catch with the first baseman, but he also does something with the bag at third. So the visiting team was always watching as well. And as a visiting team guy that in the old stadium in Texas, they were on the third base side. They still are on the third base side. You had a front view, a front seat to watching Adrian Beltre do his skit, how he prepared. And how he prepared helped him in the stretch in from the 30s to the 40s. And yep. Him going in there and being an impact.
Yeah. So really happy about him. But as I say, I've got some thoughts about the fact that 19 voters didn't vote for him for the Hall this year. Joe Mauer gets voted in. I'm guessing you probably had conversations with Joe in spring training, you know, standing at first base, maybe when he walked into the box. Give me something on Joe Mauer.
Well, Joe Mauer, I thought it was really cool. The last time I saw Joe Mauer was actually in November at the Gold Glove Awards in New York. And he was there with his wife. He was presenting the Gold Glove Awards to the catchers. I've always loved and respected Joe Mauer. I saw him also in the postseason in Minneapolis, also when the Minnesota Twins were there playing the Houston Astros, and they ended up losing to the Astros. Look, This is a Minnesota guy. It's a great story because you grow up in Minnesota. And I just had a conversation with Terry Ryan, who was a general manager when they drafted him.
Yeah.
And he said, look, you know, we drafted an athlete. We drafted a gifted athlete that was very quiet, but was very competitive. And we saw it not only when he played baseball, but when he played football. He is a guy that likes to bring people together. He's not a rah-rah guy. But he likes to bring people together. He listens to you. He doesn't believe that he is better than anyone in that room. And I think that's what keeps him humble. But most importantly, that's what you respect. And Minnesota knew that they had to choose in that first pick that year. Who do they go with? Do we go with the local kid that we know well? Or do we go out in LA and pick out Mark Pryor out of USC? They ended up going with Joe Mauer, and because they figured, you know, this hometown kid could do something special here, and they wanted to keep him there, and he wanted to stay there. So good for Joe Mauer. Did it surprise me that he was a first ballot Hall of Famer? 100% yes.
Tell you that. Okay.
It surprised me that he was first ballot. He ended up getting 76.1% of the votes and some change. Look, I'm happy for him. I think he even surprised himself with it because the conversations we were having in November, and I introduced him, Joe Mauer, this guy's going to be a Hall of Famer. He's like, Hey, hold on. It might take some time. It didn't take time. It didn't take that much time at all. And I think it's because of the way he treated everybody around him that the voters respected that, and how he respected the game. It translated to the votes.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I do think it probably bodes well because, you know, part of the reason why that Mauer may not, you know, some voters, almost 25% didn't vote for him. And maybe part of the reason why was because he didn't have big counting numbers, right? He didn't hit 500 home runs. He didn't, you know, get close to 3,000 hits. And I think that bodes well for guys like Chase Utley as we move forward, you know, yeah. Guys. Who Buster Posey, who didn't have, you know, huge counting numbers during the course of their careers, but they were impact guys. And Joe had a stretch where there's no doubt he was one of the best players in the sport. The other one who got into the Hall of Fame yesterday was Todd Helton, who his sixth year on the ballot. Tell me about Todd Helton.
Yeah, Todd, look, definitely one of the most pure hitters that I had seen in the game. When he came to the plate, you knew that there was going to be damage done, especially in tight game situations. And I think that's where it plays in a major way for Todd Helton, who another two-sport athlete. You knew that he was going to lead on and off the field. You knew that he was going to be an impact guy. But the stat that threw me off completely with Todd Helton, that I was like, oh my gosh, what are we thinking here? What are we doing? How about the year 2000? I mean, in 2000, he hit 348 with two strikes He had 92 hits and a 986 OPS with two strikes. I mean, that's the best average in a single season, and number two in hits and OPS. I mean, how insane is that? That just tells you right there who this guy was. Terry Ryan, also, I asked him earlier, I said, do you have any stories on Todd Helton? He goes, oh, man, I was watching our double-A team in New Britain, and this guy absolutely crushed us. I mean, he crushed us. It seemed like he got a hit every at-bat that he came in, and they were lasers the entire time. He could find barrel. A pure hitter was, yes, he took advantage of Coors Field, but who didn't take advantage of Coors Field? But yes, we were punishing him for that. But on the road, he was just as great as well. Obviously, Coors Field is going to up it up a little, but he would have been a Hall of Famer if he played in Oakland or in New York. It didn't matter for him.
I think it was Patrick Saunders, covers the Rockies, as you know, for the Denver Post, who I remember making this point. Like, you didn't give, demerits to Dodger pitchers for pitching in Dodger Stadium, right? And there have been a lot of Dodger star pitchers, in part because the conditions there, right? And they've had an advantage there. And then if you went to Colorado, guess what? Todd Helton and his teammates, they had an advantage there. So there shouldn't have been demerits. But I agree with you. I think there was. And it's great that he's getting in. And, you know, last week we had Jake Peavy on telling the story about grooving him that fastball for a home run his last game in Colorado, which was a lot of fun. All right. So we got the positives out of the way. All right. I'm going to go a little negative here. 19 voters not voting for Adrian Beltre, someone who had over 3,000 hits. He had 477 career homers. He was a Gold Glove third baseman at a premium position, and he was a guy who had an excellent reputation as a teammate. How in the world do 19 voters not put him on the ballot? It really bums me out, and it makes me wonder about next winter with Ichiro coming on the ballot. Like, there's no excuse not to vote for Ichiro, but I would have said there was no excuse to not vote for Adrian Beltre, Eduardo.
Yeah, look, there's only been, in the history of the voting, there's only been one guy to get the 100%. That's Mariano Rivera.
Yeah.
And I was in shock that he ended up getting 100% of the votes, because there had never been anyone to get 100%. He was not perfect as a closer. And plus, he gave up a home run to Eduardo Perez, and yet he gets 100% of the votes. Something's wrong with the system, Buster. Something's definitely wrong with the system. But with Adrian Beltre, it shocked me a couple things. I think it's an honor for any baseball writer to be able to get, to be able to have a ballot, to be able to fill out. I think it's a responsibility for them to understand how difficult it is to get into the Cooperstown, and how difficult it is as well to be able to get a ballot. And that's the stat that really shocked you. The stat that shocked me was that there were 9 that did not fill out the ballot and did not turn it in.
Right.
And that doesn't affect into the 75 percentile. It doesn't, because it doesn't, if you don't put in a ballot, it doesn't work against the player. But my goodness, if you do get one, it's your responsibility to do so. This is history. This is something that goes down into the baseball immortals.
Your name off the list. If you don't want to do a ballot, then reach out. That's what I did. You know, I stopped voting, as you know, 7-8 years ago. Jeff Passan stopped voting. You just let the Hall of Fame know, and it's over.
Yeah, you let them know. And I just look, and to me, it also saddens me that you're not voting, that Jeff Passan's not voting, because you guys are knee deep into this. You guys are not even knee deep, but I could say you guys are almost neck high into this, into the baseball world, traveling, seeing players, talking to former players, to the front offices. Plus, the data, the new data, the old data. I think that's also that's something that I have to have a meeting with you guys about. But look, and try to convince you guys to get back in. But yeah, the 19 votes, I think with Adrian Beltre, I thought they were a lot. I was also disappointed not to see Billy Wagner in. I stepped into the box to face Billy Wagner. And if there was one pitcher, one reliever that I did not like facing, and you tell me, give me the top three, Billy Wagner's in the top three.
Yeah.
I did not like facing him, because not only did he throw 100 plus miles per hour, but it was different. It was from a
funky arm angle. Right.
It was a different, it was Craig Kimbrell from the left side, except this guy also threw in, wasn't afraid to throw in on a righty. I wasn't afraid of facing a Randy Johnson because he didn't throw in on a righty. Everything ran away. With Wagner, everything comes in and at a longer distance. So that ball's traveling, but it just seems like it's picking up speed as it's coming in.
Right.
Instead of losing speed. That's the appearance that Billy Wagner had.
All right, Gary Sheffield, last year on the ballot. Oh, and by the way, just to close out about Billy Wagner, he came within 5 votes of election. This was his 9th year on the ballot. I think it's basically a fait accompli that he'll get in next year, and that'll be great. You know, that he'll, when you get that close, history says that you'll get pushed over the top. Gary Sheffield, on the other hand, man, he has a long, long wait ahead of him. He polled at 63.9% yesterday, well short of the 75% that he needs. He now goes into the into baseball purgatory with all the folks who are waiting for the special committees. And here's the thing, Eduardo, he's got to wait for the special committee perspectives to change on Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens before he has a chance, because it's pretty clear that, you know, demerits have been applied to Clemens and to Bonds, not only by the writers, but now by the special committees. Gary Sheffield's not getting in before Clemens and Bonds. What do you think about him not getting close to election?
I beg to differ on that.
Okay.
The reason I beg to differ is because I believe that Gary Sheffield has gotten more votes than both Clemens, that got more votes than Clemens and Bonds, than Bonds this time, during this time. It's because he was up front. He was up front saying that he admitted to having using the steroid cream knowingly. He was one of the first to come out and say, look, we have a problem. There's a problem in Major League Baseball with this. He was the one that brought it up to Major League Baseball and was up front about it. He got to the big leagues at the age of 19, went from the shortstop to the outfield, put up some sick numbers. And with Gary Sheffield, he's the type of guy that kids would want to emulate, that major leaguers would want to also emulate, as far as the stance, as far as the whip. These are impacts that he has on society in general when it comes to who he was. When we were kids, it was about being able to imitate Pops, Willie Stargell. It was about the Cobra. It was about Carl Yastrzemski.
Joe Morgan.
It was about Joe Morgan with the pump. It was about Pete Rose squatting down from the left side or the right side. Look, there were guys that that's what we did as kids. And Gary Sheffield was that guy, the stance, the whip. And we still talk about it. Are there quicker hands than Gary Sheffield? We bring it up, I think, if it's not Coney, if it's not myself, wow, this guy's got Sheffield hands. And to me, Gary Sheffield belongs in the Hall of Fame because he was upfront about it. When he played, we weren't tested for steroids. We weren't getting tested. And then, and that, I think that makes a big difference, because there was an epidemic going on in the 90s with players
early
saying,
2000s.
I gotta catch up. Early 2000s. I got to catch up. I got to do something if I want to stay in this game. The competitive nature of players, they'll try things. Well, he said he never injected himself. He said he never took a pill. Did he take the cream? He admitted to that. I think when we talk about character, we also have to include that as part of the character clause of saying yes, because most of the guys that have tested positive have said no, I didn't do
right.
it. Or I took something else that I thought it was.
We had, and you know, you probably heard the sound from Gary Sheffield talking to Xavier Scruggs about the process of the Mitchell report. All, you know, I think as time goes on and we move further and further past the release of the Mitchell report in the December of 2006, people don't realize, don't talk about the due process that went into that. And there was very little. And, you know, I mentioned on the podcast last week, and you live this, the Player Association advised all the players, do not speak to the Mitchell investigators. Don't talk to them. And what wound up happening was, is that if the Mitchell report, you know, the Mitchell investigators got information and they asked you to talk and you said no, then they would just put your name in. There wasn't anything proven. It was, oh, yeah, we have this article from ESPN, the magazine, in which a teammate says that he saw you do this. And, you know, would you be willing to talk to us about it? Player Association advised everybody to not talk to the investigators. And if you didn't talk to them, they just convicted you. They put you in their report. Yeah. I thought that stunk.
Well, you can also have the argument, and I guess a lot of people, because it's still current with a lot of people, and a lot of people are so much fans of it's the Yankees or the other teams that got beaten up by the Astros, is the Carlos Beltran situation.
Yeah.
Carlos Beltran, who was the player, and the players were supposedly to be kept anonymous if they cooperated and they spoke. Well, Carlos Beltran fell through that loophole because he had retired and then all of a sudden became the Mets manager, and they threw his name out there. They leaked the name out there. And that also impacted Carlos Beltran, who, if it wouldn't have been for that, and it would have been for a teammate of Mike Fiers, who started bringing up this whole situation, Carlos Beltran right now would be in the Hall of Fame. One of the top center fielders in the game, who I believe, personally, when you talk about character, taking this whole thing from the Houston Astros situation out, is one of the people that I would go and get at any time that he would call, because to me, he is a high character person. And this was supposed to be something anonymous. It works against now Carlos Beltran as well.
Yep.
So it's a little bit of a double-edged sword here. But to me, Beltran is a Hall of Famer as well.
He pulled in at 57.1% this year, which is an increase by about 20%. I feel like a lot of voters gave him the first-year penalty, much in the way they did Roberto Alomar, you know, because he was on that 2017 Astros team. I do think that the trend of him picking up basically 20% in the second year tells you that eventually he's going to get in. And I also think it's pretty clear that Andrew Jones also is going to get in. You know, he's someone who early in his the first time that he appeared on Hall of Fame ballot, he was getting 7.3%, 7.5%. Eduardo, yesterday, he was up to 61.6%, seventh year on the ballot. He's going to get in at some point now. It's pretty clear, which is pretty cool.
He should get in with the impact that he had in his 20s, unlike Beltre, who had the impacts in his 30s, right? The 30s were what made and got him into the Hall of Fame. It was Andrew Jones's early career with the Atlanta Braves that, if you look at it for that 7-year period, it was really impressive with what he did there. And let's not forget, it was Smoltz, it was Glavin, it was Maddox. Those guys benefited in a major way with that defense that Andrew Jones would play in center field. Shallow, but anything hit over his head. You looked at that number 25, and you knew that he had a chance in catching that ball over his head as well.
So next year, Ichiro, as I mentioned, he's on the ballot. CC Sabathia is going to be on the ballot. You think Sabathia will get in?
Yes.
Yeah, I believe, think so too.
I believe he'll get in.
Yep. Billy Wagner is going to get in. So it could be a pretty sizable class. Do you think Ichiro will get in unanimously?
These are all lefties, right? A lefty hitter.
You're ready. From the right should be going up there.
This is game day for me. CC, 0-4 against CC lifetime. And Billy Wagner, if it wasn't for Billy Wagner, I probably would not have gotten my 10 years in the big leagues, because it was between Brian Hunter, the right-handed hitter that used to be a former Brave, and myself. We had the fourth or fifth inning. It was Billy Wagner coming in Kissimmee, and we were both to face Billy Wagner. And it was Jim Bowden, our general manager. And he said, okay, boys, we got one spot on the roster. Let's see who can hit Billy Wagner. And I actually took him deep. And right after that day, I was on that. I ended up making that big league roster. So Billy Wagner, I love Billy Wagner. As my wife always says, I love Randy Johnson and I love all the lefties. I love Billy Wagner as well, as that was a good moment. But look, next year, it's going to be a heck of a year for the ballot. I expect, hopefully we expect a surprise. Could it be four guys getting in? I'm with you. I see three getting in, two first timers and Billy Wagner. Will Andrew Jones join that? Will Carlos Beltran have that same ascending quality of votes? I don't know if he will have enough, but I sure hope so, because if it does, There's going to be a lot of Puerto Ricans in Cooperstown.
You think Ichiro gets in unanimously?
Ichiro gets in unanimously.
Yes.
I don't see one person not voting for Ichiro. And if one does making a statement, I think the Hall of Fame and the baseball writers should sit down and really reevaluate what's going on here.
Well, you know how I feel. I think the writers should get out of it. I think they should get out of the whole process. They shouldn't be in the business of making news. I just don't like the look of them in the last 15 years, 16 years of being the morality police.
Can I ask you a question here?
Yep.
This is what I love about the podcast. When Yadier Molina becomes eligible for the Hall of Fame, and if I'm not mistaken, it's going to be the same year as Albert Pujols.
Yep.
Is Yadier Molina first ballot Hall of Famer?
He should be. Yes. I mean, all you have to do is look at, first off, just talk to people with other teams about his impact. Talk to guys who coached against him, guys who managed against him. The percentage, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think the opposing teams had 1,500 fewer stolen base attempts during Molina's career than the next closest team. Okay. Like, yeah, the fewest stolen base attempts. I mean, he completely changed the game. I once wrote an article and I wrote that he had kind of like the impact defensively, the way that a shutdown corner did in the NFL. He completely changed the game in the way that, a Deion Sanders, Darrell Revis, that type of defender, where all of a sudden the other team is like, well, you know what? The running game is not a factor here. And no one can understate the impact he had on those pitching staffs, as you know better than I do.
I agree. This is why I wanted to have that conversation before we even got off, because I agree 100% with you. Look, Yadier Molina made the team better. He made everybody around him better, and he made them accountable. He made pitchers accountable.
Yep.
Made them to be quicker to the plate, so he can have a chance. And so not only so he can have a chance to throw them out, it's so they had a chance to win, because that's all he cared about is winning. And it came about because, one, the upbringing, but two, the way that the Cardinals also developed Yadier Molina and developed him into that personality. Jose Oquendo had a lot to do with it. And I believe that he should be a first ballot Hall of Famer, and he should be going in with Albert Pujols. And I would not be surprised if both of them, I mean, Albert Pujols should be almost at the 100% as well.
Yeah, he should be unanimous.
He should be 100%. And Yadier Molina should be in the 90s. And if they're looking at the war, Yadier Molina is around a 42, 44 war, I think it is, career-wise. Shame on them for looking at that, because it goes beyond that with what you just stated there as well.
Yep. I completely agree with you, but I do think he's going to be a little bit like Maurer, where there's going to be a big chunk of writers who are going to look at the offensive counting numbers without paying attention to his impact on pitching, on his impact on defense. So, we'll see. All right, Eduardo, always great to talk with you. And I will talk to you soon.
Appreciate you, Buster.
Charlie Culberson has played in 11 seasons in the big leagues. He's 34 years old, and those pretty much have been as a position player. And Charlie, you made news recently when we got word of an agreement that you have with the Atlanta Braves and the possibility of you coming back and trying to pitch. First off, how you doing?
I'm good. I've never thrown this much in an off season before. So I'm excited for what the season holds.
All right. So tell me about this. I mean, I've, talked to you for years, bump into you. I remember talking to you in Atlanta last year. It's always a great conversation. I've talked about you in the podcast about what a great big, what a great baseball fan you are and how much you love the sport. When did this idea sort of begin to take hold within you?
I think it was last year. I mean, the Braves told me that I would be the guy to fill in, because everybody knows that all the starters for the Braves play every single day. And so if you're a utility guy, you kind of basically just wait your turn. And last year I waited and waited and waited, and two stints, I got one at bat. So I read the writing on the wall, but I kind of knew that going into the season after not making the team with Tampa and coming back home. It was just one of those things where Alex was straight up with me from the get-go. And it got to the point where in August I called Alex and I said, hey, what if I try this? And he's like, sure. I like the idea. I think it's great. I think it's a it's no pressure on the Braves at all, and it's more on me. And in my mind, I try to think positive, and I think it's a win-win. I got nothing to lose and a lot to gain. I think it's fun, and I'm enjoying it.
And you've pitched in the big leagues, 8 different appearances, you know, successful. I remember before we got started, I was telling you about how watching you in games, and you're throwing 94, 95 miles an hour, a lot of comfort level with pitching. You know, where does that come from?
I think a lot of us that are position players, now that I'm switching over to pitching, but we've pitched at some point in our career, or whether it was a little league or through high school. And I was actually looked at as a pitcher too out of high school. Granted, that was 17 years ago, but I think just being athletic, when you get a chance to get on the mound, I think I've always had the ability to like throw strikes, and I've never been the one to say, I'm going to throw a slow pitch. Like, I actually want to compete. And because I know how hard it is to hit too. But yeah, it's just another level of competing that a lot of guys don't get a chance to do. And, you know, I was able to throw 8 times at the big league level and, you know, a bump up inning, but I took advantage of it and I tried to have fun doing it. And there were some things that I did, I think, really well. And that's why I'm trying to do my best and see what happens.
So I know how competitive, you know, players can be with teammates. When Freddie Freeman and Andrelton Simmons were young position players in the big leagues with the Braves, they would talk about their pitching days, and it'd be a comment: who threw harder? Who was the better pitcher? Did you ever have that? I'm out of curiosity with Freddie, conversations with him, because he had a lot of pride with what he did as a pitcher.
Yeah, I mean, Freddie was the one that was always like, "I want to pitch." And we're like, "Freddie, they're not going to let you pitch. That's just not going to happen. They're going to let me pitch first, obviously." It's typically usually the utility guy that goes in and pitches. But I know that Freddie would love to do it. It's just a risk that teams obviously can't take. But yeah, I heard Freddie was up to 97 maybe in high school. And everyone knows that Simmons had a strong arm. And I think he might have pitched in college some.
Yep, that's right.
But yeah, it's always a fun conversation to see how hard you could throw. And you know, when guys bring it up, you know, Freddie was never going to pitch. He might not ever pitch. Maybe towards the end of his career, he might talk with Dave Roberts or whoever he's with then to say, hey, let me finally do this, to say I did it in the big leagues.
Tell me about how different your offseason's been in preparing for this spring as a pitcher versus past offseasons.
Yeah, I mean, I think every offseason is so different. Sometimes you start early, sometimes you start later. There's been times where we've had stuff going on in the offseason where I really didn't start until January, hitting and throwing. And, you know, as a position player, you have to get your arm in shape, but not pitching shape. And so I told myself, and I talked with my wife about it, I was like, if I'm going to do this, I got to go all in. And so after the season, teams that are in the postseason, they had their stay hot camps. And so I went back to Gwinnett and threw a few times there just to keep throwing and use those guys to help me. And then I think I took 2 weeks off. And then the first week of November, I jumped back in at the Maven Baseball Lab here in Atlanta. And there's a ton of guys from hitters to pitchers that are just working. And again, I've been going at it for almost 3 straight months with a little time off in between. But I've put a lot of time and obviously invested in myself. And it's one of those things where now's the time to do it. There's no need to just wait. And maybe there's a hope that happens. Now I'm actually giving myself a chance this year because of the change. I don't have much time left, and I get that. But it's been a lot of fun. I've learned a lot, and I'm excited to get down to Florida and throw in front of those guys.
When did you first get up on a mound in this offseason? What was that like when you're doing it for the first time and preparing for the future as a pitcher?
I think the biggest thing for me, one of the biggest things was just trying to clean up my mechanics, because I've moved a certain way for so long, throwing the ball from, you know, short, third, second, even throws from the outfield. You know, everybody moves so differently. And with the technology that we have today to help improve everything, I wanted to get to the point where I looked like a pitcher, but still it's like, oh, I could tell that he was a player. He was a position player. It's kind of funny. I don't want to fully look like a pitcher. I still want to be athletic looking on the mound, even though there's a ton of athletic pitchers. I'll just say that. I think it's just more of cleaning up my delivery to be able to repeat pitches. And then the next step was to repeat pitches, not just throw a fastball. I'm throwing cutters, I'm throwing sliders, different shapes, throwing a changeup. So like seeing what works for me and then just making those pitches that much better.
Give me your personal evaluation now on you as a pitcher. Where do you stand?
In my mind, I stand at the top. Because I feel like, I mean, I know that's not the case, but I feel like in order for you to do something, for you to take such a big leap and doing something different, you have to kind of talk yourself into it. Like, you can't just be down. You can't say, oh, this might be okay. Like, I mean, there's been days where it hasn't been great, but I feel like those are the days that I've learned the most. You know, as you're preparing, as you practice, even as a hitter, like, you're not going to be great every day. But I feel like as I've gotten older, I've learned that through my mistakes and through days that I'm not as good, let's learn the most from those days. I mean, if we went and we were great every single day, then the process wouldn't be as fun. I threw a bullpen yesterday and it was better. So it's been an up and down thing for me. Early on in the offseason, my second bullpen, I feel like I was great. It's like, oh, I'm throwing 94. I'll get to 100. This will be easy. And it's kind of been like this and then up a little bit. But I've noticed that I've thrown for almost 3 straight months too. And I've done a lot of things that I haven't done before. So again, I'll go back to it. I've learned so much. But I know in my mind that I can do it. That if, and not a knock on everybody else, but if all these other guys can do it, I know I can do it too.
Give me the pitch right now that for you is a focus. You know, I always love having those conversations with pitchers in the spring and they're tinkering, they're working on something. You know, Max Scherzer is always a fun one to someone who's fun to talk to because he's working on the shape of his curveball or maybe he's working on his slider. Right now, other than the fastball, what's a pitch for you that is a focus?
I think it's so one day, I threw a split changeup a few bullpens in a row. And it was hard. It had a ton of movement. So I'm thinking a ball that goes down and into a righty, obviously down and away to a lefty, something moving the other way.
Yeah.
But then the last couple of times I've thrown it, it hasn't been as good, but my slider has been better. So for me, it's working on throwing my slider harder. Because as a position player, you think I'm going to throw a slider, I'm going to make it move. No, it's more about the grip that I've learned and your mechanics, and then the thought of just throwing it as hard as you can. And so now it's like, as I know as a hitter, if that slider's 14, 15 miles an hour slower than the fastball, like that's easier to react to. But if it's 7 or 8 off maybe, and it's hard and it's still moving, that's a tougher pitch to hit. So I think the slider's the one that I'm trying to focus on the most, just to bump up the speed on it.
So who have been, as you know, especially with changeups and splitters, as you say, the grip is a big deal. And talk to so many pitchers through the years who pick up a grip in conversation with another pitcher. Sometimes it's tinkering, throwing on the side, but sometimes it's literally being shown a grip. Your split change, who talked to you about that grip?
Yeah, so I started the process in Gwinnett last year in August. And I came to a grip that felt comfortable in my hand that I know that I can control. And then I was playing with Alan Winans. Alan got a shot, 4 or 5 starts last year in the big leagues. He had a couple of really good starts. And Alan was a great resource for me for a changeup. He adjusted my grip just a little bit, and he throws a really good one. And so he's a super confident guy who finally was able to crack the big leagues last year and show that he's capable of doing it. But that was one guy, was Winans, who kind of adjusted my grip just a little bit. And now it's just the thought. It's like, don't make your pitches try to move. You get your grip and you be convicted in your pitch, in your mind, that you just throw it and then it'll do what it's supposed to do.
So you've been a really popular teammate in your career in the big leagues. As news of this has sprinkled out, tell me about some of the who have you heard from, you know, what sort of feedback you getting from guys you played with?
Yeah, I think a lot of guys are excited for me. You know, there's not too many guys that I feel like will take that next step in trying this. You know, I'm with a lot of guys right now in the group that I've been throwing with that are excited for me. And just here and there, it's more of like, some of my best friends that are like encouraging me, obviously family too, but those are the guys that, you know, I talk with them about it, or my wife's never heard me talk so much about pitching or baseball really in general in the off season, because it's just something new and something fun. So I've had a lot of people close to me that have kind of rallied behind me. And then obviously you hear people like the fans that, again, Braves fans are great and they've always liked me. And it's cool to see the support. So yeah, it's just an exciting new thing for me to do, to accomplish, to show my wife that I can do it, to show my kids, my three children, that, hey, dad is still working in baseball, but going to try something new. Like, I want to show them that it's okay to try something new that's hard, that you can still do it. Just because it's different and hard doesn't mean you can't do it.
Last one for you. I was going to ask you about your wife. When you're preparing to call Alex Anthopoulos, tell me about those conversations and her reaction when you hang up the phone and asking you about that.
One good thing about it is I live here in Atlanta. I live close to the park. And so I was kind of back and forth with Gwinnett in Atlanta this year, or this past season. She was the biggest one that supported me. She was the one after spring training last year that said, hey, why don't you call Alex? Like, I have a great relationship with Alex. He is straight up and honest with everybody. And she's like, why don't you just call him and talk to him? And as things got further into the season, it was like she was the one that was behind me in this. If I was going to do it, might as well do it at home. It wasn't the easiest season for us as a family, just because of the unknown of everything, or my kids going to the park all the time. And my son was like, dad, I love going to the games, but like, why aren't you playing? And so I'm like, son, that's just part of it. Like, I don't have control of that. It's just one of those things where that's just how it worked out. And now with this transition to pitching, she's been probably my biggest supporter. I mean, she's listened to me talk so much about this, but she's behind me. And for me to leave the house in a few weeks with all the kids in school and so much going on, she's definitely a saint for allowing me to continue my dream and trying something like this.
All right, Charlie. Well, I can't wait to see you pitch in spring. I'll be down in the, you know, in the western side of Florida, looking for that opportunity. Good luck. You're gonna have a lot of people rooting for you this year.
No, I appreciate it. I'm excited. Just excited to feel that adrenaline again and get on the mound. And again, my mindset is I've already won. And I might be a little different person on the mound, because I'm treating everybody the same. I want to be a nice guy. I want to be a great teammate. But on the mound, you have to have a little different side to you. So it's just go out there and compete. And I'm just going to give them my best stuff.
Oh, I was going to say, we're going to see, like, you've seen the Pitching Ninja videos, I'm sure, the struts and that sort of thing. It's going to be, is that what you're talking about? Like, finishing up hitters?
I'm going to respect the game. But I want to go out there with the mindset of, like, I have the ball. I have control of the situation. And I'm on the mound, like, everyone's waiting for you, right, as a pitcher. So my mindset is just to be the best I can. That's it, bottom line.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Charlie. It was great to talk with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me today. Look forward to seeing you down in Florida.
For the ones who get it done, Grainger offers high-quality supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as access to product specialists who have the knowledge and experience to answer your toughest questions. Plus, their commitment to being your safety partner can help you keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
0-0-9-6.
This is The Numbers Game with Sarah Langs.
Sarah Langs, reporter, producer for MLB.com. Sarah, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great, Foster. How are you?
I'm doing well, knowing that this is going to be a really tough taping for you, okay? Because it should, and it should be easy, because it, you know, Hall of Fame vote that was done on Tuesday. You're saturated with numbers. You got all kinds of notes. We're going to hear some of those coming up. But I'm going to insist that you talk about yourself for a moment.
Oh, no.
Because as usual, there's an interesting development in your life, and you don't tell me about it. I find out after the fact. And in this case, what happened was is that I talked to you last week and then found out, I think a couple days later, that there are now scholarships that are being bestowed in your name. Tell me about that.
Oh, my goodness. Yes. So the Society for American Baseball Research, SABRE, reached out to me over the summer with this idea to have a scholarship for women to go to their annual conference in March in Arizona. Women who are in college or high school and young students, and they awarded the scholarships, I believe, officially sometime either late last week or early this week. So three young women, two college students, and one high school student will be headed to the SABRE conference to mingle and make connections and learn so much. And I can't believe that is in my name, but yes, I have. I did not talk about it much because that's not what I do. I mean, I'm so honored. I made that clear. I hope, and I'm not about to say, hey, guess what they're doing for me, because that's not how I approach it.
Never. You never have. And that's why, you know, always after the fact, I just hope that, you know, my hope every week is that when these things pop up in your name, that, you know, they happen just before the podcast. So they're going to ask you about them in a timely manner. All right. Let's get to the Hall of Famers. Let's play the numbers game.
Number three
is 12. So we'll start with Adrian Beltran. He is one of 12 players in baseball history with at least 3,000 hits and 400 home runs, along with Henry Aaron, Albert Pujols, Alex Rodriguez, Willie Mays, Rafael Palmeiro, Miguel Cabrera, Eddie Murray, Sam Usual, Dave Winfield, Carlos Stronsky, and Cal Ripken Jr. Just an amazing player, and I like that because I like the accumulation. How long he stuck around, how long he persisted, is so much of a part of why he was there. Last night, getting 95.1% of the vote and going into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot.
Number two is,
we'll go with 306. So that was Joe Mauer's career batting average. That is the fourth highest among more than 65 players in MLB history who played catcher at least 50% of the time and had at least 5,000 plate appearances, behind only Mickey Cochran, Bill Dickey, and Mike Piazza, and his 388 on base percent is third on that same list.
Number one
is 400. This might be my favorite stat of these three. So in 2000 and 2001, Todd Helton had more than 400 total bases in each season. He is one of four players to have at least 400 total bases in consecutive seasons. Listen to the other three. Chuck Klein in 1929 and 30, Lou Gehrig in 1930 and 31, and Jimmy Fox in 1932 and 33. Four times in baseball history, three times in this quick little four-year span in the 30s, and then Todd Helton. Just incredible to me.
Absolutely. And, you know, we listened, Sarah, at the top of the show to all the calls that each of them got.
I love those
are so much fun to, you know, hear the reaction of their family as they get the news. I said to Eduardo when we had him on, I was just shocked shocked that 19 folks found a reason to not vote for Adrian Beltre. Can you think of any reason, Sarah? Like, when I criticize writers, I sound like a blowhard, but I think you can make the statistical argument or the argument on facts that everyone should have voted for him. What did you think about that?
I mean, I've said this now so many times on here. So many guys in baseball history should have been unanimous. I immediately think of Willie Mays, and I cannot think of a single reason or 19 reasons not to vote for Beltre. Luckily, the bar is 75%, so it doesn't matter, but it's just kind of silly to me.
And, yes.
You know, we'll get whatever ballots chose to be public beyond the ones we already know at some point. But, you know, there's always that difference between those who choose to go public prior to the announcement and those who gatekeep it or keep it forever, at least until the Hall of Fame reveals it. And we all know that it's a drop-off. No one gains when those final ones get revealed, and I always wonder about what's going on with those motivations.
Yeah, and the idea, and I've said this to you before and talked about this, the idea that a union of journalists, which the Baseball Writers Association is, not a formal union, but it's an association of journalists, the idea that they would keep their votes secret, some of them, is crazy to me. Can you think of a reason why anyone wouldn't vote for Ichiro next year? He's the next one to be a test of this, Sarah, people deciding that for whatever reason, they're not going to vote for these slam dunk Hall of Famers.
I absolutely cannot. And I will say that I believe the BBWA has voted to make all of the ballots public at least once or twice in the past. And it comes down to a conversation between them and the Hall of Fame. And I'm 98% sure they were going out 100. That the BBWA as a whole did vote to make all of their ballots public, but that there was some sort of holdup in passing that.
Yep, that's exactly right. Yeah. It was the Hall of Fame whose decision, and their feeling was that, you know, there's some writers who are not comfortable having their names identified. And my response to that when I heard that was, well, then don't vote. You know, if you can't stand the heat, then don't go into the kitchen. Ichiro's numbers, 3,089 hits, 362 doubles, 96 triples, 117 homers, 509 stolen bases, ton of gold gloves, ton of all-star appearances. And this is someone who came over to play in the major leagues when he was in his mid-20s. So I really hope that writers who were thinking about not voting for Ichiro next year kind of decide to get over themselves and do the right thing and vote for Ichiro and have him become the second player to be voted in unanimously.
You know, right. My favorite Ichiro thing is that if you remember, he ended his career with those two games in Japan at the beginning of the 2019 season when the Mariners went out and played the A's. So if not for those two games, he would have been on this ballot. How funny is that?
Yeah, no kidding. Right, exactly. I can remember in the middle of that game, the news breaking that Ichiro, this was it. Like those two games that he played in Japan, that was it. An amazing player who captured the imagination of a lot of fans, and he should be honored next year, Sarah. All right. Thanks for doing this. As always, great to talk with you.
Thanks so much for having me, Boston.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
Hembo, of course, is Paul Ambikides, the highest paid researcher in the industry. $701 million guaranteed deal earlier in this offseason, surpassing Otani. Hembo, how are you doing this week?
Buster, I'm doing great. I'm enjoying all the fruits of my labor, and so are my ancestors. I always appreciate you putting me on to be able to pretend like I'm making all this money, even though it will be them and someday the IRS coming after me and them for this illegal deal that you have concocted.
Right, 100%. Reese Hoskins got a contract not nearly as large as yours. 2 years, $34 million with the Milwaukee Brewers. I know this is something, Reese Hoskins, a player near and dear to your heart, you being a Phillies fan. What was your reaction when you heard this news?
Yeah, so I think the Phillies made the right decision in transitioning Bryce Harper to first base full time. But I also think that this is an absolutely outstanding opportunity for Rhys Hoskins, who is truly one of my favorite Phillies ever. Someone who was there for all the lean years and was still embedded in that community and hit and did so at a high level in the middle of that lineup forever. And it kills me that he was not a part of this team's success this past year. All that being said, I like to tell Brewers fans what they're getting, and they're getting a really good at-bat, or I guess perhaps better stated, they're getting 500 good at-bats long as he's healthy and that knee can recover from his injury. I'll tell you what he is. First of all, he's super patient, Buster. So among 194 hitters to have at least 2,000 plate appearances since 2017 when he debuted, his average of 4.41 pitches per plate appearance ranks first among all 194 of those hitters. He has an excellent approach at the plate, and that is evident every time you watch him hit. Secondly, he has massive, massive pull side power. Among 123 right-handed hitters to have put at least 500 balls in play to their pull side since 2017 when he debuted, Buster, the only hitters with a higher slug are Aaron Judge and Mike Trout. So we're talking about a hitter who sees a lot of pitches and does so in a way that gives him a chance to walk nearly 100 times a year and has enormous pull side power going to play in a ballpark that is very friendly to right-handed hitters. I like the fit a lot. I think he fits in really, really nicely smack dab in the middle of that lineup. No, I think he's obviously a much better fit at DH because he's not going to add any value with the glove. And look, he can't run either, so he's not exactly a war darling. He's going to be a value-positive player for Milwaukee. My hope is that he hits a lot this year, hits free agency next year because he can opt out and winds up making himself a lot of money.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right in all that. I think the Phillies made the right decision to move on because when you looked at the Phillies and you know their potential going forward, having Bryce Harper in the infield improves their defense significantly. It's not only that Bryce might be a little better than Rhys defensively, but of course it means getting Kyle Schwarber out of the outfield. It's freeing up the DH spot and getting Schwarber out of there. That was the right decision on their part. And it's nice to see the Brewers have had a quiet winter participating in free agency because the National League Central is very winnable for all these teams.
They're a very interesting team to me because they got some really nice young players. I can't wait to see what Jackson Chourio does, obviously. They're bringing back Yelich. Contreras really exploded last season. I think they're going to retain Willy Adames. They should score some runs, and that's been their biggest issue. So yeah. I'm hearing a lot of people whose opinions that I value say they're not going to trade Corbin Burns this offseason. I like it when a team doesn't necessarily like go for broke, but when a team recognizes that we still have a meaningful chance of making the playoffs when they improve their club in the margins. Rhys Hoskins is going to make them a better team. Rhys Hoskins has been an impactful middle of the order bat for good baseball teams. He has. And I think he'll make a big impact there. It's a great fit. And so long as they keep that pitching rotation together, I think the Brewers are going to be live. I wouldn't necessarily handicap him, Buster, as the National League Central favorite. But would it stun me if they won 88 games and found themselves playing October baseball? Absolutely not.
And I tell you what, there's some pressure, I think, on the front office on owner Mark Adnazio because they just lost Craig Counsell to their division rival, the Chicago Cubs. They will not want the narrative if they have a bad year in 2024 that Craig Counsell was the reason for their success. But that's kind of what's at stake for them in this year. All right. I sent out a tweet the other day after we got news about James Paxton's contract with the Dodgers. You know, it's worth about $12 million, some incentives built into it. And I just mentioned, if anybody is saying that baseball is dying, look at James Paxton's contract, okay? This is someone who's 35 years old, right? 35 years old. It's been 5 years since he threw 100 innings in any season, okay? Last year, he had a 4.50 ERA with the Boston Red Sox. He allowed 18 homers in 96 innings. And look, I get it why the Dodgers are interested in him. He had 5 great starts early in the year, high velocity. He was striking guys out left and right. But for the most part, in the last 5 years, James Paxton has either been hurt or not very good. And Hembo, he got $12 million to pitch at the back end of the Dodgers rotation. That money, you know, they're not just doling it out as a charity. The sport right now, absolutely rich in money. You can talk about imbalance between teams like the Dodgers and, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays. But the fact is, there's a lot of money being doled out this winter.
Yeah, Buster, I think we have at least I can speak for myself. I have a very antiquated view of this stuff because every time I see a contract, I ask myself, oh, that guy's worth that much money? And when you ask yourself that 20 times, maybe The answer is yes, because that's what the market is saying.
Yes.
I think the second thing that you said, or the last thing that you said, I should say, was perhaps the most instructive. This is the kind of move that really enables a team like the Dodgers to strut their financial stuff, even more so than like the $700 million fake dollars that Ohtani got. Because like what you are effectively doing here, Buster, is saying, I'm willing to flush $12 million down the toilet. I'm willing and to light $12
million. There's a fair chance that's going to happen based on recent history.
It's 117 innings in 5 years with an ERA plus of 92. I mean, there is no reason to believe that James Paxton is going to be good. That, Buster, is the biggest difference between the Rays and the Dodgers. Not just the fact that we can go sign these mega contracts. It's the fact that we can take flyers of that magnitude. Would it surprise me if James Paxton shoved in October for the Dodgers this year? It would not surprise me. It also wouldn't surprise me if he threw 41 and two-thirds innings, and by the time we got to August, his scapula acted up again or some such nonsense, because that's what happens. The same thing would not surprise me when it comes to Tyler Glass now, but the Dodgers are an embarrassment of riches. All that being said, it's not my money. If you want to punt $12 million on the off chance that James Paxton is James Paxton at a time in your season when it matters, more power to you. But you're 100% right. Baseball is awash in money, and anyone that believes anything to the contrary is not paying attention.
Josh Hader gets $95 million over 5 years to maybe be the Astros closer, maybe share the duties with Ryan Pressly. What did you think about this move?
I think that, Ohtani aside, there is no move that will happen this offseason that is going to impact the championship more than this one. Josh okay. Hader on the Astros is absolutely nasty. It is a cherry on top of the tastiest pitching staff in baseball, in my opinion, Buster. I don't think that there's a staff that has a better blend of like high-end starters and high-leverage relievers than this one. I think this is why it is such an incredibly important move and an incredibly strategic move. In the 2022 postseason, when the Astros, of course, won the World Series, that staff had a 1.38 ERA and allowed an OPS of 4.33 in innings 6 and 7, right? Those swing innings are critical in the playoffs. Last year, notably, they did not win the World Series and got knocked out by Texas. In those 6th and 7th innings, it was a 5.73 ERA,
yeah,
and they allowed an OPS of 8.66. What he enables you to do is build the bridge. What he enables you to do is condense what you ask your starters to do. Like, the presence of Josh Hader is obvious. He's ridiculous. He pitched last year and struck out 85 guys and allowed 6 extra base hits in 56 innings. He is a video game. He's one of the nastiest relievers I've ever seen. And if we're going to put Billy Wagner in the Hall of Fame next year, Josh Hader should own a wing in that place. I think he is absolutely outstanding. He is going to absolutely make a difference in terms of who wins the championship this year. And I would say, as of right this second, I would put the Astros back in the World Series, because they're going to have a pitching staff from the heavens. Once you get to the 7th inning, Buster, you're going to be cooked. These guys are so good, and you're going to be able to condense what you asked your starters to do. That bullpen's going to be unbelievable. I absolutely love this move for the Houston Astros.
All right, they load up on the bullpen. So do the Angels, who have not spent much money at all on their rotation, but they are stacking up in the bullpen. They signed Robert Stevenson, $33 million deal. They re-signed Matt Moore. That news came out late on Tuesday night. What do you think about the Angels' chances in the American League West in Ron Washington's first year as manager?
I'm probably lower on the Angels than I would say consensus. There are a couple things that I know for sure about the Angels. I think they're going to score some runs. I'm higher on some of their young players, some of their young position players than most. I think that Mickey Moniak showed something last year. I think Logan Ohapi is going to be a really good hitting catcher. I think Zach Neto's a really nice little bat in the middle of that order. And if you get 140 games from Mike Trout, like, you're going to be at minimum like a 4.5 runs a game type offense. And when you throw darts at your relief pitching, like the way that they are, I think they should be decent in high leverage. But it's not obvious to me how they're going to have a lead, because I think they might have the worst starting rotation in the American League, Buster. And not only, as I'm looking at their depth chart right this second, do I see an obvious way that they're going to be a decent staff, they have absolutely nothing in the pipeline. And that's something that I often do at this time of year. I ask myself, all right, when inevitably X, Y, or Z happens and your rotation deteriorates, what can you draw from? What can you pull? Which is one of the reasons I love the Dodgers last year, because they had guys that they could draw from every single year in double and triple A and get outs at the big league level. There is not a single pitcher right now in the Angels organization, from a starting standpoint at least, that you look at and say, he can get outs for us literally this year. So the it's going to be a razor thin margin. If they happen to be in contention in the summer, they'll probably look to add someone again, but they don't even really have anything to trade either. So I think from a run prevention standpoint, they're going to be pretty awful. And that the sort of shots they're taking at the bullpen, while I think helpful maybe on the margins, isn't really going to matter because their starters stink on ice.
The 2024 Angels to me are a great science experiment about culture. And I kind of can't wait for it to play out. Look, I don't think there's any chance that they become relevant in the race unless they get, as you mentioned, 140 games out of Mike Trout, 140 games out of Anthony Rendon. And I will say this. I think one of the reasons why the Braves ascended over the last 6 years was the incredible energy that Ron Washington, Eric Young brought to the ballpark every day. I mean, you played at a much higher level than I did. To be around the group of players, you know, before games, 3 hours before the game, there's Wash talking with the players. They're all laughing. They're out doing those infield drills that you saw, you know, getting juiced up in the dugout, you know, the accountability through humor that was brought with that whole group. When someone would screw up, everybody called him out. They made a base running mistake. It was like, man, you blew that. Boy, you look like awkward. Let's try to make that better going forward. I'm going to be fascinated to see the impact of Wash and EY for this team that, let's face it, I mean, they're at the bottom of the barrel in baseball in terms of, and that's not to say that, you know, like Phil Nevin is not a guy who's a good baseball guy or Joe Madden's not a good baseball guy, but there's something unique about the energy that Ron Washington and Eric Young bring in a sport that, as Anthony Rendon knows, is played 162 games over 185 days, as he talked about the other day. I think there's a chance that makes a difference. Are you buying or no?
I think that there's a chance, but I think it will require a Herculean effort. I think the ultimate job of a manager, condensed into one sentence, would be you're going to get more out of your players than you should. If the majority of your players hit their 70th percentile outcome, you're going to be better than you should be. And one way that you can make that happen is by fostering a culture that everyone enjoys. Because if everyone is happy at work, everyone's going to perform better at work. And their attention to detail at work will be better too. And that's something that has been evidenced in their defense and their base running, by the way. And that's theoretically something that they should improve under Ron Washington. What I can say for sure is that all those things can matter only up into a point where if Mike Trout plays 60 games and if Anthony Rendon plays 30 games, none of it will. Like in the end, it's going to require people to have big, big individual seasons, 5, 6, 7 WAR at a time. Because aside from that, you're not going to win, especially in that division, by having a bunch of 2 or 3 WAR players, which they didn't even have last year, by the way, except for 2 of them. And one of them is gone now, of course. So I think Ron Washington was the perfect choice. I just think he was handed practically an impossible deck. I think he, if anyone can do it, especially in that division, it can be him. But man, that is an awfully competitive time to be in that division. And I think from a talent standpoint, they are mostly devoid of it.
If there was a metric for fun, the Braves over the last 5 or 6 years, they would be the Major League Baseball leaders. Dodgers, you felt that. You felt that with the Phillies. You know, last year they seemed to have a great time. And it'll be interesting to see if the Angels have more fun with Ron Washington, Eric Young being the third base coach. All right, Hembo, thanks for doing this.
Later, friends.
Get out of here, Hembo. Sick of Hembo.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. Quick session here. Corey Rukert, he writes in, help me understand how Maurer is first ballot Hall of Fame. Piazza, the greatest hitting catcher, didn't make it until his fourth year. Maurer played 40% of his starts at first. Maurer and John Olerud have similar stats, and Olerud got 1% of the vote.
Olerud. John Olerud, of course, an excellent first baseman, but look, I think when it comes to the steroid era candidates, we're going to look back at some of the voting totals and go, what? Like the idea that Andrew Jones gets 7.3% of the vote in his first year in the ballot sounds crazy, but then you realize that he was affected by all the Hall of Fame guys, all the steroid era guys who were lingering on the ballot. And so I think Piazza was affected by all of that because, you know, he was in the same ballot and it was hard to get room when you're talking about, you know, Roger Clemens and Barry Bonds and Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa and all that. I think it made it harder for Piazza to get voted in.
Interesting. All right, let's close it up with Andrew Campbell at Real Camp Drew. Bringing it back to what we started, we talked about at the start of the show. He writes in, can I ask why Gary Sheffield gets a pass on the Mitchell Report, but Andy Pettit does not? Pettit was arguably the best left-handed pitcher of his era, had similar career numbers to guys like Mussina, Sabathia, Greinke, and he still has the postseason record for wins.
I don't think either one of them got a pass. I think basically for Sheffield and for Pettit, being in the Mitchell Report has been disqualifying. You know, and maybe Sheffield got more, a higher percentage of votes, but you know what? I think he was a better player. I think Sheffield was, you know, in terms of his impact, over 500 home runs, you know, batting champion, all that. I think he actually was a, if you were just ranked players, I think he would have been ahead of Pettit, and neither one of them have a chance right now to get the Hall of Fame because of the Mitchell Report. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Bummer.
I mean, I think they both have been hurt by it. Man, I think it's silly. I don't understand why the writers have just decided that, you know, we need to continue to be the morality police here. Just pick the best players and put them in the Hall of Fame.
Nobody cares, you guys. You guys are hanging on to this thing. Nobody cares about it anymore. Sorry. You're living in a bygone era, hanging on to this relic, this grudge. So sorry to Andy Pettit. Bummer. Maybe we should have him on, just like Gary Sheffield explained the whole thing. That could be fun.
Oh, and Andy would have some stories.
Yeah, yeah.
That it would be fun to talk with him. Maybe we'll work on that in spring training. All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Charlie Culberson, to Eduardo, Sarah, Hembo, and Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.